Project we began earlier in the summer. Haven't had a whole lot of continuity with it just because of the different things that happened to go on at 1 o'clock, particularly over the last 3 months. So I apologize for that. But we're going to take up the subject again. And that is the offices of the church, particularly in this case, elder and deacon. That's the topic. And we do this in anticipation of having elections for those offices as well. So it's an important topic to cover, and this is a give-and-take format, back and forth, so if you have a question, I see we have one already. For real? Okay, go ahead. Right. I can absolutely refresh you. The main texts we looked at were... And I'll give you a real brief summary of what we said about them, too. Exodus 4, 27 through 30. Exodus 17, 1 through 6. Back up. That's the wrong list of things. Okay, the three main texts we dealt with were Exodus 18, Numbers 11, and Deuteronomy 1. Okay. Exodus 18, Numbers 11, Deuteronomy 1. And a brief summary of the things that we found there. We'll start with that as well. Can you remember anything, George? Go ahead. Although dude is not a Hebrew word, I doubt that I don't think he called him dude, but you got the gist of it, right? Anyway, yes, yeah, it started with that, right, the need for it was seen as the body grew bigger, and it wasn't just sort of a patriarchal clan like we see in Genesis, but now you have nationhood, now you have a big group of people, and all of the complexities that go with having a big group of people, and that Moses alone couldn't handle those things, so elders are appointed in response to the need of a growing body. And they were appointed from the heads of families. Remember, we talked about how the family was always the first testing ground for elders in the church, where it begins as a family office, then it becomes a corporate office. So, you know, Moses said, pick from among the heads of your families elders to serve the greater context, the bigger body. So, and we see that emphasis, too. We're going to see it when we come to 1 Timothy, as we will today. That's an emphasis there, too, that the testing ground is first in the home, right? You've got to rule your own house well before you take more responsibility in the house of the Lord. So that qualification has long and deep roots, right, that go back to the Old Testament. We did see how the people were involved in this process, that Moses actually said to the people, go and choose from among yourselves. In other words, their discernment of who had these particular gifts was very much part of the process. It wasn't just sort of Moses, you know, acting as the one sole authority and say, you. But the people's perception of who was best qualified for these offices, that was taken into account, as it is in our time as well. All right. So these are people who are voted on by the congregation. And the primary characteristics of the elders that we saw in Exodus and Deuteronomy in those passages. And it's interesting because when we look at 1 Timothy, what we're going to see is a list of character traits, a list of graces and gifts. But the emphasis that we saw in Exodus and Deuteronomy was really focused, and it was not the emphasis of 1 Timothy. And that was, remember the big three? There were three we talked about. Think of Chabad. Remember Chabad, that acronym? All right. Wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Okay. Those three things. And that's what Moses calls for. Look for men with wisdom and knowledge and understanding. Right? They knew the word. They knew how to apply it. They knew how to adjudicate between people if there were conflicts or such things as that. So men who knew the word, number one. Secondly, knew how to apply it. Right? And were eager to do that and to do that in an even-handed way. That was the emphasis of some of those Old Testament texts. A lot of other texts that we could look at. We have to keep moving along and try to be a little bit succinct. We can't do this particular topic forever. So today what we're going to do is jump to probably the passage you think about most when it comes to elders and deacons, and that is 1 Timothy 3. But we'll see some of those points from our Old Testament study reflected here too in 1 Timothy 3, where Paul gives the qualifications for elders and deacons. Let's start here by reading this text. 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 13. This is a faithful saying: if a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous, one who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. Moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into reproach in the snare of the devil. Likewise, deacons must be reverent. Well, we'll read this text. Our focus is going to be there on the first seven verses, but let's read those for deacon as well. Likewise, deacons must be reverent, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy for money, holding the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. But let those also first be tested, then let them serve as deacons, being found blameless. Likewise, their wives must be reverent, not slanderers, temperate, faithful in all things. Let deacons be the husband of one wife, ruling their children in their own house as well. For those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a good standing and great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. All right, here for a couple of weeks we're going to focus on the first seven verses. I think, as I read these verses and sit down to think them through and kind of sketch out the picture of an elder and how he's described here, the thing that strikes me most is the thing that's unsaid in these first seven verses. And that is how no man is sufficient for this. Paul is not describing me. He's not describing any other elder that I know. He's not describing, that perfect man that you have to have in your church who fits all of these things perfectly. This is a high standard, and it should humble the heart of anyone who holds this office or aspires to hold this office, because no man is sufficient for these things. No man measures up to these things. Really, what this passage describes is Christ as our elder, as our shepherd, right? It is he that is perfectly blameless, right? Temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable. I mean, all of these positive qualities point us to some characteristic of Christ and in some way that he ministers to his people. So that's point number one. And I mean, we can't take our eyes off that, right? Because this isn't about, finding, the best guy for the job who's head and shoulders above everyone else and fits this list perfectly, and that's him. That's not anybody. All right? We all struggle in these things, and elders do as well. So this is a high standard, one that lifts our eyes high enough to see Christ and how he fulfills it perfectly. But one that really we have to take with a humble heart, especially someone who is in this office. Now, it's instructive to elders and those who elect elders, right? Because this is convicts the heart of the elder. This is the way you need to be for the sake of Christ and his church. But then also people who have to discern these gifts and cast a vote for these people, right? You have to be discerning too, know what the office is all about. So it's good for us to all study this passage and understand it more clearly. Am I too loud right now? No. Okay. I feel loud to myself, but I'm not too loud to you. Okay. All right. Well, let's take it from the top. Paul begins, "This is a faithful saying. If a man desires the position of a bishop," that's how it's translated in New King James, the term is episkopos. Right? And that sounds familiar to you, like episcopal and Episcopalian. That's based upon this word, too. But episkopos means what? overseer, right? Okay, so bishop is the way that it's sometimes translated. It means overseer. Okay, and it's another descriptive title. Remember back in the Old Testament, we were looking around and we saw all these descriptive titles for the elders. They were called judges, they were called heads, they were called elders, all these different descriptive titles. And we find it being the same case in the New Testament, where they are called elders, presbyteros, right, which means literally elder, like old person, but also an overseer, right, episkopos, that's what it means. Now, these two terms, you could look at that and say, well, you have overseers, episkopos, then you have presbyteros, elders. Maybe they're two different things, right? Maybe you have bishops, and they're the guys with all the authority, with the big hats, right? And then you have the elders, the overseers, they're kind of a lower authority, right? A gradation of offices. That's not how it works. These are two terms for the same office, and they're used interchangeably. Now, one place where that really comes out clearly is in Acts chapter 20. And allow me to take you there and show you where Paul is talking to the elders in Ephesus. And he uses both terms to refer to them in the same group of men, in the same context, the same instance. Acts 20, verse 17. From Miletus he sent to Ephesus and called for the elders of the church. That's presbyteroi, elders, plural. And then in the course of his admonition to them, he says in verse 28, look down to 28, therefore take heed to yourselves and to all the flock, among which the Holy Spirit has made you episkopoi, overseers. Okay, so he calls them, calls the elders, and then he calls them episkopoi, overseers. So it's the same office, it's the same men. All right, just two different descriptive terms for that same one in the same office. Does that make sense? Did you follow that connection? All right, good. Yes? Okay. You're thinking about the word, you might be thinking about the word for office itself, which is perkuda, which means to visit. Because I did something with that in the last lesson. Maybe that's what you're thinking of. Does that make sense? Have you had me for Hebrew yet? No, you haven't. It'll all be clear to you when you take this school year, right? Are you taking Hebrew? Right. Greek. Ah, okay. Well, we'll have a lot of work to do then. Okay. All right. Anyway, Brian was asking, does that word mean to visit or some such like that? That was your word. Well, presbyteroi, it refers to elders. You know, it means elderly. I mean, even in our terminology, with Presbyterian Hospital. I mean, I don't know if that's based upon Presbyterian Church affiliation. Or is that why it's called? Okay. All right. Forget that. But in any case, that Greek prefix will be in instances where it refers to older people, like elders or elderly people, which are usually elders in the Bible. But the word that you're talking about, pekuda in Hebrew, is the word to visit. The verb is pekuda, to visit, and it's the same word for office. It's the word that's used whenever God says, I will visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation, or visit the iniquity, or visit you in kindness, or it can be positive or negative, but God's visitation, right? That same word is the word for office in Hebrew, which means visitation, to be with, to be near, right? And the verb on which episkopos is based, right? Episkeptomai is the verb. And it means the same thing, right? You had Greek just recently, right? Or something? Okay, all right. It also means to visit. So, when putting these words together, what's the impression you get, like semantically and biblically? The whole idea of the office is to, right, visit. We talk about elder visitation. We talk about that contact or connection that elders have with people. That's very much part of even the language that's used to refer to the office itself. Okay, so that's an important thing to bear in mind. So when Paul talks about a bishop here in verse 1, he's talking about an overseer, which is an elder. Okay, so we have to draw those lines and connect those dots. Now, look what he says. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. Now, one of the first things Paul says about this office is that it is a good work. That's what he says. Now, he's not meaning to say, like, this is a position based on merit, like a good work, like there's merit involved to it. He is calling it, like, it's work, number one. He characterizes it under the notion of work. But it's a good work in the sense that, you know, it's not meritorious. It's good for the church. It's a needful office. It's something that results in the good of the body. It's a good thing, he says. All right. But I want you to notice this, too. He doesn't call it a good position. He doesn't call it a good thing. He doesn't call it a good time. He doesn't call it a good anything. He calls it a good work. Work, right? He characterizes it under the notion of labor. All right. And that's what the office is. And I think, to our discredit, we do often think of this office as a status or just in terms of its position or authority or some such thing as that. Paul characterizes it under the labor, under that notion of it, it's a work. And if someone desires that work, that's a good thing. So think about it in those terms, really. Let's not think of elder as someone who has this position, this authority, this something to look up to, right? It's a work. An elder is a worker. There's a certain work that he has to do, that God gives him to do, and the aspects of that labor are laid out in our text. Now, of course, the Bible tells us to honor the elders and, you know, to respect the authority that comes with the office. But it's not characterized that way. That, to me, is very powerful and runs contrary to how we often see this office, right? We have to think of it as a work, as a labor, right? And that's really what ordination means and is all about, being set apart to do a certain work. Right? It's as simple as that. Any thoughts there at that point or any questions?
Yeah.
Yes. Your question is how does an ordination take place? What does it look like?
Is ordination just for the elder that feels like he's called a pastor, or is it for anyone that's called to be an elder in the RP?
Okay. Okay. That's a good question. The question is who gets ordained in the RP church? Is it someone who's just a pastor, or elders who are not pastors? Okay. Okay. We, as a church, have a view of the church that has two offices. That is, an office of elder and an office of deacon. Now, there are others in the Reformed world, even some in our own church, who see that there are three offices, who think teaching elder or pastor and ruling elder are two different offices. Okay, and then there's deacon. So that would be a three-office view. The two-office view, which we take as a denomination, is that there's only one office of elder. And there's a division of labor in that office. There are some who teach and some who rule. So we have teaching elder and ruling elder. But it's the same office, the same authority. Okay. And so everyone who gets ordained to that office gets ordained. That is a teaching elder and a ruling elder, because it's technically the same office of elder, but with just different functions. But we still refer to people as either teaching elders or ruling elders. Like, I'm a teaching elder. But at the same time, I serve on a session and I don't have any more or less authority than a ruling elder does on a session. So I'm in that office of elder, but as a teaching elder. Right? So there's a distinction of function, but the same office.
And where is the distinction between how the PCA and the RPC is the elder thing about ruling and teaching? Are you seeing it as one?
Oh, I think the PCA does also have two office view. Am I correct on that?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh. Okay.
Paul
Two?
I've seen both two and three in the PDA.
Okay, so we don't know. Well, I think that it's a difficult issue. I didn't really know. But to answer your question directly is, ruling elders get ordained too, right? Presbyterians, so we have the other elders lay hands on them and ordain them just the same way with a teaching elder. Yeah, so. But that's a good question, though. That gets that's an important thing to hash out. Yep. Oops.
To be a teaching elder are different than that of a
That's right.
Because
that's right.
One does not need to have and live yeah. and pass the same number of seminary or presbytery examinations to be a ruling elder
that's right.
to be a teaching elder. Am I correct?
That is correct. To be a teaching elder, there are a lot more hoops. A lot more exams, a lot more school, a lot more all that stuff. And that's not because we because we look at them as two different offices. In a sense, we do. All right, sort of unofficially. In a sense, we do see them as two different offices. Because practically speaking, like for instance, really only a teaching elder is supposed to officiate over communion or to give the benediction and to officiate a wedding and things like that. Those things are reserved for teaching elders, but if it really were the same office, then you could have a ruling elder do those things just as easily. We don't do that. We make a distinction of purpose and function in the body, and even though we still look at it as a singular office. Is that confusing enough? Okay, good. Cassie.
Who are the deacons?
Who are they? you know, I'm going to get to deacons in about 3 weeks, I think. It's going to be an important subject because the function of deacons in the church is a controversial and misunderstood thing for centuries and centuries in the church. Some people just saw them as the people who handle the money, right? The bean counters of the church. That's what deacons do. Other people, what's that?
We have deacons now.
Oh, yeah, we do have deacons. Oh, that's what you were asking. Who actually are our deacons? All right. If you're a deacon, raise your hand. Frank Hunter and... Okay, well.
So deacons don't have the same qualifications as elders.
Right. The deacon qualifications are in verses 8 through 13. We'll get there. We will get there. All in due time. No. But anyway, that's going to be an important topic in its own right. So stay tuned for that one. All right. Okay, I forget what we were even doing. Two offices, three offices, okay. But let's keep our eye on the ball here on verse 1. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. Now, I was emphasizing the fact that it's a position of work. It's an office of work. It's not just a status or authority. But notice also that he does say if he desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. You have to desire the work with the position. A person should not say, I would like to have the position and I'll put up with the work. Or, you know, I'd like to have the work in order to have the position. The position is the work. The work is the position. You notice that, okay? It's not a status thing. It's labor is what it is. There's a certain labor to it. And that's what Paul is emphasizing in verse 1. Now, he also underscores the whole idea of desire. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. We shouldn't pass over this statement of desire here, because a man should not be forced into it, talked into it, casually open to it. It should be something that he desires to do, right? That something that the Lord has put on his heart and called him and equipped him to do. And have a consciousness of being pulled in this direction, to have this conviction, to do this work in the church. That should be something that arises in his own heart and mind. Now, there are, of course, situations in which people can discern certain gifts in someone else, and that person is very hesitant to do something or, you know, propose themselves for an office. They might feel immodest doing that or some such thing. But if people discern certain gifts and qualities in someone and approach that person, situations like that do arise. It's not always that easy, that internal calling, right? Oh, I feel called to be an elder. I read 1 Timothy 3 and that describes me to a T. That's me. No one says that. I mean, if someone does say that, that's a big red light, right? It doesn't work that way. But at the same time, a man can feel that a desire to do this work, and yet an inadequacy and the need for God's grace and all of those things wrapped up into one. That's important. And it's important to not force someone into it or compel them to it. There has to be an internal and an external call. I'll get right to you in one second. Let me explain these two things. The internal call is a sense of, I believe that the Lord has called me to do this. I believe that he's equipped me in some measure to do this. I have to rely on his grace, of course, but I think this is what I'm supposed to do. My own sense of that. That's internal calling. Now, it's not something mystical. It's not a voice. It's a sense of I need to serve the Lord, and here's my gift set, and here's how I can do it. The external call is the church around you, the people around you discerning that same thing. Both of those things have to be there together, working in conjunction. What Paul's talking about here in verse 1 is that sense of internal calling, right? It should be there. And in the way he describes it, a desire for the work of the position. George.
I guess I wanted to get your commentary on this particular point, the desire for the work. We already made it clear that you don't desire the office of any kind of trustee of heaven at the wrong end. You don't look at the qualifications and go, oh, that's it.
Right. Okay.
And see how it works out. I'm really paraphrasing it terribly, but rather than saying you must have this deep and abiding lightning strike type experience that says the Lord is calling me to do this, very
Yeah, that's an interesting tact to take. John Gerstner did something like that, too. And I remember hearing him say this when I was young. I was a mid-teenager, maybe. And he said this, and it really struck a chord with me, because he said that every young man should go into the ministry, period, unless they're called to do something else. And I thought a little more, but that's a striking way to put it. And that's what Murray was saying in that same. I don't know if I agree with that 100%. You know, I mean, I don't know that there should be this blanket encouragement for everybody. I don't think that's quite the point here. But I think it's useful for people to be encouraged to say, don't assume it's not you. Right off the bat, I think some people do that, right? Assume, well, I know this elder and deacon stuff. That's someone else. That isn't me. Don't assume that too quickly. Because it may be, because honestly, every one of us feels that way. It has to be somebody, and God calls people who might not otherwise feel that great urge or sense of calling, may well be called. Some are called, fewer chosen. Some are cold and fewer frozen. I've heard it that way. No, you're right about that. You're right about that. It's something to discern. And I would say this as well, that it's always good to try to understand if you have a sense of calling by talking to elders, by talking to a pastor, and trying to work through that with men who are in that position. And trying to get that input, that's an important part of the process as well. So, yes? Okay, that's a good point as well, that he, desire or not, like qualifications and desire are two different things, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay, and someone could desire it and not be qualified, but someone could be qualified and not necessarily have that desire at the forefront of their mind, and that would have to be something that they would discern or, and come to recognize, but is that the thrust of what... Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. They both have to work together. They really both have to be there. And a man's internal sense of calling may be a bit weaker, but the external sense of calling to him might be much stronger. They see maybe what he doesn't even himself see, or it could be the opposite. So that's a good point. Both of those elements need to be there. Verse 1 talks about an internal call, but then verse 2 and following really talking about these qualifications is really, Paul is giving us a structure of what to look for in terms of an external calling, like what a congregation needs to look for. What are the qualifications? So both of those elements are here, right? That internal and external point of the calling. This word desire, if he desires the position of a bishop, it's interesting. The Greek roots are instructive, too. How they bring together ideas, and desire is two roots that mean to reach for, right? Think of holding a little baby, and you hold something in front of it, and what does it do? If there's desires there, it reaches right for it, try to grab it. Reach for is the imagery here. Let me ask you this question: what does that mean? I mean, just desiring a position is one thing, or desiring the work is one thing. You can just say you desire it. But I think to use a word like this, that kind of imagery, really reach for, is a little more concrete. It's not just I have this vague desire, I want to do something, but he reaches for it. What do you think that means, or what does that look like? Okay, good. Joyce, do you have another thought?
Something like that would have the desire or work to prepare for it, to make sure for all patients to check itself out,
yeah,
and to have a sense of,
yeah,
communication with the Lord.
Yeah.
Preparation.
Okay, good. That's a good answer, too. Rocco.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a good point as well. That's all that input is good. And my thought was along those lines too, that when it talks about aspiring to something or reaching for something, and then it gives a list of all these gifts and graces and things that you should see in an elder, my mind goes to the thought that these are things already seen in his life, that these are things that he already, if he aspires to the work, then he's already seeking to be hospitable, seeking to be temperate, and you know, this list of things that we'll now see. In other words, he's not a man who says, well, if I'm elected as an elder, then I'll be temperate and hospitable and not violent, and I'll be all these things once I'm an elder, right? He tries to be those things in the first place, right? And so that's a way of reaching for it, aspiring for it, right? That these are part of his normal life. He's striving in these things anyway. And by the way, most of these things here are not just unique to elders. Most of these are just aspects of the Christian life, fruit of the Spirit, that really everyone, I mean, every one of us is called to be not greedy for money, gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous, sober-minded. I mean, we're all called to be that. And I think this business of reaching for desiring this position will be seen in those avenues. Here's a guy who's serious about these things, right? And that, to me, constitutes reaching for it, right? That kind of thing. Yes? That's right. Yeah, setting the example at home, right? Right. Exactly. That we've come full circle to that point again. We saw that in our Old Testament text. That's a good point to bring up. Yeah. That's okay. Right. That's right. That's the difference. Me? Yes, pastors. A teaching elder is the same word as a pastor, is the same office. In other words, a teaching elder and a pastor are the same thing. Right. I am a teaching elder. No matter where I go, that's what I am. So I'm a teaching elder on the session of this church. But right now, I'm not the pastor of this church. Let me put it this way. A pastor of a church is someone who's elected to pastor that church. But you can have a pastor on the session of a church who is not the pastor of the church. Does that make sense? The ruling elders here are Jim and Jay. All right. And I'm a teaching elder, but we all do the same thing on the session. Yeah. Right. No, because no, even serving on a session without being the pastor, I'm still a teaching elder. Right? I never morph into a ruling elder. Yeah. Yes.
Once an elder in the Presbyterian church, always an elder.
That's correct. And so I've never ever been a ruling elder. Never. Exactly. That's part of the office itself. And to being able to teach. And that's not like standing up in front of a crowd of 30,000 people and being able to teach. That's just having the ability to, even in a one-on-one set. I mean, there's many avenues of teaching, right? So teaching elders may have a more comfortable time in front of a bigger group, whereas ruling elders might not. But ruling elders still have to have the ability to do that, right? At some level. Let me go to Rocco back here. Go ahead.
Right. Give out benediction.
Right.
However, for example, Jake could go up there and preach. If it was a session slow time to do so,
yeah.
He'd go up there and preach, you would have to go out with a benediction and then hand off Sabbath.
Yes, a ruling elder can preach. On occasion, I mean, there's the guidelines for it are not so cut and dried, but it's called occasional preaching under the oversight of the session, just like a seminary student might be able to do. All right, it's allowed and so on, but it's not to be a regular thing. Like a ruling elder couldn't regularly fill the pulpit at a church in almost a pastoral capacity. It just couldn't do that. Sacraments are another thing. Generally a teaching elder needs to be done. Now, in extraordinary circumstances, a ruling elder can do it. But there's still that division made in our constitution and the way that we do things. Back, your question, Cassie, was a good one. A pastor is a position in a church where someone calls a teaching elder to be their pastor. So you can be a teaching elder, like Tom Reed's a teaching elder also. And he could be a member of this church, but not be the pastor. And that's how it's been with me. I've been a teaching elder, but I'm not the pastor, but I'm still serving on the session. Right. Yeah. Sorry. I should start with an explanation of all these things. I didn't know that we, okay. All right. Anyway. Let me see where we are and what time it is. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We got started. We got our foot in the door, and we talked about verse 1, right? So, now, here's your homework. What I'm going to do in this list, I'm not going to do it systematically, like the first thing in verse 2, verse 3, verse 4. What I'm going to do is I look at this list, and I see three different things. And they're all mixed together. I see gifts, graces, and circumstances. Gifts, graces, and circumstances. A gift is an ability. A grace is a fruit of the Spirit or a character trait. And a circumstance is a circumstance of life, like husband of one wife, right? That kind of thing. So what I want you to do is take all these characteristics in this list and put them in those three categories. Try to categorize them correctly between gifts, graces, and circumstances. Okay. Okay. A gift is an ability, like teaching. A grace is a character trait, like temperance. And a circumstance is like a circumstance of life, like he only has one wife and not two. Or some other circumstance of life. Does that make sense? Okay. Age, right. Novice, being a novice, or right, things like that.
That's a life circumstance.
So, if that's what I want you to do. I want to take those three categories and then put everything in this list into one of those three categories. And we're going to talk about that. Which one of those categories has the most things in it? In other words, where is the emphasis of this list? Is it on gifts, graces, or circumstances of life? Think about that. Process that a little bit. Come next week with your homework done. And we'll go from there. Sound good? All right. Okay, yeah, it's slow going. I like your questions. That's good. That doesn't. I like the interaction, the give and take. That's a good thing to maintain. So even if we have to take it a little bit more slowly, that's fine with me. But really, my overall plan is to maybe in another, I would say, 2 more weeks on this subject with elders. And then I'd like to do 2 or 3 weeks on the subject of deacons. So we're looking at maybe, you know, another month or two months maybe of this subject. And hopefully just in time and timed right for the elections that we're going to have for elders and deacons. I don't know when that'll be. I'm thinking end of September or October. It might be around there. I'm not sure. But we'll try to time all these things and of course, keep you up to date with that. Obviously, we've been really occupied with the pastor search and that issue. So that has taken sort of the lion's share of our attention at this time. But this is just as important. So we are going to give our attention to this as well. Okay, any last questions? Yes. That's true. I mean, if he has a wife, he only should have one. But I think that... yeah, I don't think it means he has to be married to have the position. Yeah. But if he is married, only one. Okay, let me pray and we'll end.